Well, this week we finish up our study in the book of Numbers. We have a double portion, Matot and Maaseh, and these are usually grouped together. And the general outline is this. It covers seven chapters. In chapter 30, it gives instructions about vows and oaths. And we talked about that a little bit in the Torah service. Chapter 31 is the war with Midian and its aftermath and the division of the spoils. Chapter 32, Reuben and Gad's request. And that's what we're really going to focus on most today. Chapter 33. It's one of those chapters you kind of skip over because it lists the 42 encampments from the time they left Egypt until the time they got to the plains of Moab, ready to cross the Jordan River. 42 encampments at all. But we're going to talk about that number 42 and what it represents. Chapter 34 describes the boundaries of the land of Israel. 35, the establishment of Levitical cities, cities of refuge. And chapter 36, what happens when a lady from one tribe marries a man from another tribe? What happens in that case? So that's chapter 36. After we finish Numbers and we get to Deuteronomy next week, Deuteronomy, nothing new is really happening. Deuteronomy comes the word ditto, the Latin word or Greek word ditto, which means a repeat. And Moses, it's a long speech by Moses where he kind of reviews the history of the last 40 years. He reviews many of the laws and the commandments. He encourages and warns the people to stay faithful. So the whole book of Deuteronomy basically is review. God kind of put in a cap over the whole thing. Now, at first, I had planned to talk about the main things in chapter 30 and 31 and 32, and if we had time, 33. On the way over here, talking with Robin, we got to talk about that number 42, and by George, we're going to start with that. So I'm going to go way down to the end of my notes, and we're going to start with chapter 33. The transforming power of 42. Why are there 42 encampments? And if you look at them there, I challenge you to go through and just number them. Number one, number two, number three. When you come to the name of an encampment, put a number by it. And there are certain things that happen at certain points, certain historical events in the Torah. You can identify which encampment, which number that was along the way. And you'll discover that in the first year after leaving Egypt, there were 14 encampments. Numbers 1 through 14 took place in the first year. In the last year, the 40th year, encampments number 35 to 42 took place. That's a total of 8. And during the 38 years in between, there were 20 encampments. Now, one of the things I want to say is that we often kind of look down our noses at this generation of Israelites because they failed so many tests. They whined and moaned and groaned about stuff, and they got rebellious, and they'd fall away. And yeah, they did do that. But you think over a period of 40 years, their track record's not all that bad. If you've been an adult for 40 years, what's your track record like? How many times have you fallen off a wagon and griped and complained and lost your faith and fallen into temptation? Or how many times have you messed up? So honestly, track record's not that bad. It could have been better. And all these things that happened to them were for our encouragement and for our instruction, as we know. But there's something very informative, illustrative about these numbers. Because you know, in Hebraic thought, numbers are letters, and letters are numbers, and words are numbers. And so when rabbis read the scriptures, they read it on both these levels. So in the first year from the Exodus from Egypt right on up until they get up to Sinai and spend almost a year there, there are 14 encampments. Well, 14 equals the letters Yud and Dalet, which spell the word Yud, which means hand. And didn't God guide them by his hand? During the 38 years where they had to spend all that time because that first generation rebelled against God, they fell into fear and complaining, wanted to go back to Egypt. So God says, okay, you spent 40 days exploring the land. You decided you don't want to go in. You're going to spend 40 years exploring the wilderness. And that's where you're going to die. Well, if you take those 20 encampments there, they're equal to the letter kaf, which means palm of the hand. Now, there's a lesson there for us. Even during that time where they are rebelling and they're moaning, wanting to go back to Egypt, and they're spending 38 years because of their rebellion, they were still in the palm of God's hand. They're still there. They were in his hand when they left Egypt, and they were still in the palm of his hand all during their whining in the wilderness. It's like that little baby who's screaming and crying and kicking and squirming and trying to get out of your arms, that you're still holding him, right? You're not going to drop him on the floor. You're still going to hold on to him and do what's best for him. And during that last year, that 40th year, there were 8 encampments, and 8 is the numerical value of Ket, which stands for life. New life. So even these numbers, I think, have a lot of value. But let me ask you a question. You don't see 42 in the Bible too often. You see 40 over and over and over and over again, right? 40 years in the wilderness. Yeshua spent 40 days in the wilderness being tempted by the enemy. There are 40 days and nights of rain at Noah's Ark, the flood. And you just see 40s everywhere, all over the place. What's the deal with 42? Well, think of it this way. When they left Egypt, I'll start on the right-hand side. They left Egypt and they encamped in Sukkot. That first journey, journey number one, was filled with joy. God had crushed the Egyptians. They were leaving slavery, walking out in freedom. They were walking out in life. They were singing, rejoicing. They were thrilled. And you go over to the last encampment, encampment number 42. They're right on the banks of the Jordan River. Right on the banks. They can see the promised land right there. Jordan River, most places, is no wider than the length of this aisle. It's not like the Mississippi or anything. It's just a very narrow river, and some places much narrower than that. They could toss a stone over into the promised land. They're right there. And they know they're going in. Think of the joy. They realize the 40 years are over. Now, the 40 encampments in between, that was a whole different story, all right? Not a whole lot of joy in those 40 in between. The power of 40, what 40 always represents in the scriptures, transition. But 42 puts the bookends on it. The joy at the beginning and the joy at the end, but in between, not so much joy. It's just testing and difficulty. But it's important to get to number 42. You understand? So wherever you see 40 in the Bible, without fail, it represents this period of testing and transition. And it's encoded for us in this chapter. This is where it really is illuminated for us. And you have to understand, too, that the wilderness is ordained. If you look at a map of the Middle East, you can look at it and see they could have just gone straight from Egypt right into the Promised Land. They could have gone right there. They didn't have to go through the wilderness at all. Just go straight north, and they're home. God took them out a different way. He had them do a big U-ey, a big detour, and go way out in the wilderness and then come back in from the east. Why? Because you don't get to the promised land without going through the wilderness. You never get to the joy ahead without going through the pain that's here. That is a principle of life. There's no way of getting around it. You either go through the wilderness and come out the other side, or you die there. Those are your two options. But you can't dodge the wilderness. That just doesn't happen. So, in your life, when you're in the wilderness, the enemy will come to tempt you like he did Yeshua for those 40 days. And one of the things he'll do is say, well, if you were really faithful, if you're really righteous, if you really love God, you wouldn't be out here suffering in the wilderness. And if he ever says that to you, you're looking back and say, no, this is about right. This is where I'm supposed to be. This is the way God has led me. And he'll lead me through testing to get out the other side. So just shut up your mouth, leave me alone. I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. And I'm going to endure it. I'm going to go through it and come out the other end. And I'm going to rejoice. You understand? You don't argue with the enemy. You out-truth him. There are some other 42s in the scriptures, by the way. In Matthew chapter 1, there's this genealogy of Yeshua that starts with Abraham and goes right on up to Yeshua. And then in verse 17, Matthew summarizes the genealogy. He says, so all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. From the deportation of Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. What's 14 plus 14 plus 14? 42. So it begins with this great time of joy. Abraham. You know, the first 11 chapters of Genesis, 11 chapters, okay, it's this many plus one, that many chapters, 11 chapters, covers over a 2,000-year period. 2,000 years. But then the next 15, 16 chapters covers about 175 years, just about that much. What happens at the end of chapter 11? Abraham's born. And when Abraham comes on the scenes, God says, okay, let's slow it down. I've been rushing to get to this point because Abraham, he's my man. And he's the only man in the entire history of the world that God made a blood covenant with. And if you walk by faith, you are a child of Abraham. If you have given your life to Messiah, you've been grafted into the covenant God made with Abraham. Abraham is our father of the faith. And God couldn't wait hardly to get to Abraham. This is now we're going to slow down. This is the important part. Everything else was just building the stage. With Abraham, now the play begins. So from Abraham to Messiah, great joy at the beginning, great joy at the end, with 40 generations in between, of ups and downs and failures and testings. You get it? You know, the Shema is six words. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. But we always, after we say that, we then say the next few verses. And you shall love the Lord with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your strength. And these commandments I command you today shall be upon your heart. And you'll teach them to your children. In your home, when you lie down, when you rise up. And then it talks about writing them on your doors and then writing them on your gates. See how it starts with the heart, moves on out to the gates. That section after the Shema, exactly 42 words. Because it's a transition from internal to outside. Because everything starts in the inside. God flows from the inside out. He works from the inside out. And that to me is kind of amazing. Torah scrolls. We reference the Torah scroll. If a Torah scroll is made correctly, there are 42 lines in every column. And that's not accidental. So these are some things to keep in mind with 42. 40 is the testing, but 42 are the bookends. The joy at the beginning, the joy at the end. Okay? Got it? So keep that in mind next time you go through testing. Okay, let's start the teaching where it's supposed to start, the beginning. All right, here we are. What I'm going to do is take chapters 30, 31, and 32, depending on how much time we have, and and just bring out some of the highlights. During the Torah service, we read chapter 30 about oaths and vows. I call these dangerous oversteps. God never commands us to take oaths and vows. Now, if you have to appear in court as a witness, they're going to put you on the stand and they'll make you take an oath. Take the oath. That's okay. It's all right. If you made vows at your wedding, that's fine. Keep those vows. But a lot of times we take upon ourselves vows and oaths that we just decide to take on ourselves, that God did not ordain. And all throughout Jewish history, and Yeshua himself always warned against taking upon ourselves oaths and vows that God does not command. There's this passage in the Jerusalem Talmud that says, has the Torah not forbidden you enough that you wish to forbid yourself more things? I don't want to read you a passage from Rabbi Chaim Miller. He's a wonderful commentator, a young guy who commentates on the Torah. And this is what he says. He says, making vows of abstinence, therefore, to deprive yourself from enjoying the physical world is really a sin. Deriving benefit from the physical is as much a part of worshiping God as putting on tefillin and praying. The important thing is that your actions should be carried out for the sake of heaven, for sake of God, and not for the sake of your own personal gratification. Remember, who created every single pleasure in the universe? God did. Satan never created a one. And as C.S. Lewis describes, the enemy wants you to take the pleasure that God created, and he wants to get you to enjoy it at the wrong time, in the wrong way, or to the wrong degree. And after he's addicted you and trapped you in that way, he removes the pleasure altogether, because that's the part God contributed. But the pleasure itself came from God. Satan never created one in his life. In his existence, he never created a pleasure. God created them all. So we are to enjoy the pleasures God has created for us, but we're to do it in his way, in his time, and to the degree he says. And then we maximize the enjoyment. And what Miller is saying here is that when we enjoy the pleasures God has created, and we enjoy them in the way the Torah instructs us, it's an act of worship. You understand that? We tend to think of Judaism as being kind of cold and dark, and those people are miserable, have no fun. Oh, they have fun. But they do it according to the Torah. And if you've ever seen Orthodox Jews dancing and rejoicing as I have, when you're at the Western Wall on Shavuot and Pentecost, and that place is jam-packed with people dancing before the Lord and praying and singing and music, you've never seen such rejoicing in your life. So God wants us to enjoy the pleasures he's given us, but let's do them the way he says to do it. That way we are in control, and those pleasures are something not only that we enjoy fully, but they're also something to give praise and glory to God as well. Yeshua said, "But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Just let your yes be a simple yes, and your no a simple no. Anything more than this has its origin," where? "In evil." Talk has become so cheap these days that sometimes we feel like we have to add on the words, "I swear what I'm telling you is true." If you are doing that, that means that most of the times you're talking, maybe it isn't true. So you have to give a little extra punch to it when it is true and take an oath. Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. Be known as a man or a woman of truth, a person of your word. Keep your word. Don't go beyond that. The sages say that taking a vow or an oath that where you don't have to is like building an altar outside the temple. It's almost, the way they talk about it, it's almost as if, okay, God's given me commandments to keep. But you know what? That's not enough. I need more. Put more weights on the bar so I can show you how strong I am. I'm going to take an oath to abstain from this forever. And I have an oath. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. So we start adding more commandments and more responsibilities upon ourselves that we have made that he hasn't. You see where that comes from? That comes from ego and pride. So let's be very careful of taking on ourselves things that God did not ordain. Chapter 31. the war with Midian. When you read this, the opening words, they sound pretty dire. And we talked about this a little bit at the Torah service. But in chapter 31, it starts like this. Adonai spoke to Moses saying, the vengeance for the children of Israel against the Midianites. Take vengeance for the children of Israel against the Midianites. Afterward, you will be gathered unto your people. Then Moses spoke to the people saying, arm men from among yourselves for the legion that they may be against Midian to inflict Adonai's vengeance against Midian. And he goes on to take 1,000 from each tribe, even Phinehas, the priest, to sit along with the trumpets and the precious objects, assuming the Ark of the Covenant accompanies them. This is serious battle, and basically they're commanded to go in there and just wipe them out, all of them. And when you read this, it sounds, well, this is pretty harsh and cruel. Isn't God love? Why do all of this? Well, the name Midian means strife and contention and judging. Now, when you read this chapter and you picture it as a war, not against a people group, but let's read it spiritually as it applies to us today. God is saying, I want you to make a war. And he says, take 1,000 from every tribe. In other words, he's telling you, from every part of your being, every part of your personality, I want you to arm yourself completely from head to toe to take vengeance against strife, contention, and judgmentalism in your life. And I want you to wipe it out. I want you to destroy it. I want it to be gone and done with. We are not to be a people of negativity. We're to be a people who are positive. We're to be a people of blessing, not of condemnation. People of light, not of darkness. And he wants us to eradicate negativity from our lives. He wants us to be merciless about it. And this is something I'll confess I have not been very diligent at in my life. I thought pointing out people's flaws was part of being light, you know, about speaking the truth. Well, it isn't. When you look at how Yeshua interacted with the sinners of his day, you don't see condemnation at all. He got condemned for eating with sinners. But he was called a friend of sinners. Not a condemner of sinners. The only people you see Yeshua ever really being harsh with are the hypocritical leaders of his day. There he cut loose. Because there was no other way to reach their hearts. And even the harsh words he said were said out of love and concern for his people. Because he knew that what these people were bringing was destruction upon Israel. And sure enough, 70 years later, their country's destroyed, their temple is destroyed, they're carried away into captivity. And it all rests on the shoulders of this small group of leadership. And that's where you see him cut loose. He sometimes says some things a little harsh to his disciples. But these are his disciples. They're like his children. You can spank your kids if it's really necessary. I know that's not politically correct, but if you want your children to be correct, you may have to bring some physical discipline into their lives. And Yeshua once in a while will say something harsh, but it's always to teach, always to penetrate, always to bring out fruit. But he used it in a very, very, very measured way. He was so careful about it. One of the reasons I become so sensitive to negativity, I've been reading a book, I'm halfway through, and I'm really enjoying it, and it's really convicting me. And so I'm going to go ahead and take a chance commending the book. Just got to switch those letters in there. Commending the book, and it's called Positivity Bias. It's by Mendel Commonson. And it is mostly stories and sayings by Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, who is the Lubavitcher Rebbe for so many years, a godly man. And it really has had an impact on my life. But I really catch myself when I start to say something negative. Even if I think it's instructive and true, it's like, you don't have to say that. I just want to give you a few quotes from the book. He says, "It's not the events of our lives that shape us, but the meanings we assign to those events. In other words, if you change the way you look at the things you look at change." When we begin to speak negatively about others and about things and about circumstances, what happens is we become people of negativity. The enemy is pure negativism. Everything about him is negativity. But everything in Messiah is yes and amen. And so we need to be careful how we look at things. Here's an example. I don't know if you've ever seen this picture before or not. I'm not going to have you raise your hands. But people who look at this picture and the first thing they see is an old woman are generally people who are negative. This has been proven scientifically. But people who look at this picture and see a young woman are people of positivity. Now, some of you can't see the old woman, and some of you can't see the young woman. So let me help you out here. I see some of you pointing out to your friends there. What's what? Let's find the old woman first. Okay, there's her eye right there. There's her nose with a lump on it, all right, big wart. There's her little thin lipless smile and her sharp chin right there. You see that? There's the old woman. You can't see the old woman? All right, let me fatten up my, let me do this. All right, here we go. One more time. There's her eye right there. And then there's her big nose. There's her lip, and there's her chin. Now it looks like she's got shaving cream all over, doesn't it? Okay, you see the old woman now? All right, here's the young woman. The young woman is actually looking kind of off to the left. Her nose is right there. Just that little bump is her nose. This is her chin right here. This is a necklace around her neck. This is her ear. And she's looking off that way. See the young woman? It's a brilliant picture. But you understand by this how two people can look at exactly the same image and see two completely different things. Think of all the situations you've been in where you saw it as a negative. And then go back and think, how could I look at that and see that as a positive? I remember an example. I think Rabbi Akiva Tatz talks about it. Let's say you arrive here from another planet. And you step into a near building. The nearest building is a big building. You go through the doors and you come through a door. And you see a person strapped down to a table, and there's another person with a sharp knife cutting this person, and blood's going everywhere, and the person is screaming, and it's violent, and it's ugly, and you think, oh, this is a horrible place. Then later, someone explains to you, no, that's a surgeon who's performing a cesarean section on a pregnant woman. She's giving birth. And you watch, and then soon she's holding the baby, and the surgeon there is smiling and grinning, and the nurses are applauding, and she's smiling, and she's kissing this baby, and it's all joy. So what was ugly and horrible and violent and bloody turns out to be something of great joy. But you had to wait through. You had to see it from a different way. And almost everything in our lives can be seen from two different vantage points. We can see something horrible our children do. But we pray for them and we wait, and we see God take that and turn it to a real teaching lesson and a correction in their lives. And they become mature and more wise because of it. Maybe a health issue you encounter. You go through it, and then later you come out the other side. And God does some wonderful thing through that even. A financial loss, all kinds of things. And if we really trust God to be in control, then we trust God to be in control. We trust that he's got his hand in everything that occurs and that it's going to have a good outcome. Let me read this to you. This is a passage from the book. It says, according to neuroscientists, our brains have developed specialized circuits that register negative experiences immediately in emotional memory. A negative experience, your brain records it immediately in emotional memory so that we can learn from them. On the other hand, most positive, now listen to this, most positive experiences flow through the brain like water through a sieve. We experience them, enjoy them, and quickly forget them. Accordingly, we use much more brain space to scan and process negative experiences than positive ones. Because negative stimuli, if not registered and responded to appropriately, can be fatal. This is only natural. But we're supposed to be above the natural. We're supposed to be supernatural. So yeah, you touch a hot stove, you get burned, you have a negative experience, you'll probably never touch a hot stove again. You understand? You have a wreck while you're texting and driving, you'll probably never text while you're driving again. Because that negative experience is so locked in, it could save your life. That's okay. God built us that way. But as a supernatural, spiritual people, the positive experiences should stick in our hearts and souls and minds just as much. But unfortunately, we let them just flow through our brains, like it says here. And we forget them. So many times I've met people who have experience some great answer to prayer, some great act of faithfulness that God has done for them. And I tell them, okay, now hang on to this. Don't forget this. Drive a post in the ground at this point in your life. Don't ever forget this milestone in your life. And then a week or two, month later, God, I just don't know where God is. I don't know if he hears me. It's like, did you forget? I remember what God did in your life a few weeks ago. What happened to you? And it's like it never happened. It's like they completely forget. We need to be people who can remember the positive. It says, similarly, if we have 9 positive experiences or interactions during the day and 1 negative experience, it's the most likely that at the end of the day we'll remember the negative experience most vividly. And that's the truth. So anyways, this is a couple more quick quotes you might want to write down. You do not see things as they are. You see things as you are. If you see more negative things in your life and around you than positive, that's because you are negative. If you see more positive things in your life and around you, it's because you're positive. You see things through God's point of view. Night is banished through illumination, not elimination. We want to go stamp out the darkness. Why don't you just try being light instead? Now, what does Yeshua say? Let your light shine before men such a way they may see your good works and glorify your Father's is in heaven. People of light, and I need to get my color back here. People of light are people who are filled with good works. And their good works light up the lives of others. And I used to think I had a gift for pointing out the things that are wrong in people's lives. I'm great at pointing out the darkness. You come to me, I'll point out every dark thing in your life. But that's not what Yeshua did. Yeshua, the light of the world, he took them and helped raise them above the negative things in their life. After meeting him, they saw life in a different way. They were more alive than ever. They knew God better than ever. They had more joy than ever. But people of light and of good works are people of joy. There are times we have to grieve. It's only natural. If you never grieve, then you're not human. There are times we grieve. There are times we're sad. But if you are a person who is lacking in joy, you probably have a lot of sin in your life. Because as a general principle, joylessness is sin. You owe it to other people to be happy. If you call yourself a representative of God, a faithful one who knows him, who loves him and knows the future he has for us, how dare you be joyless? you're not a believer at all. You can't believe in the God I know, and the God of the Bible, and not have joy in your life. Something's really broke if you are not a person of joy. But don't sit there and try, okay, I'm going to try to cheer myself up, you know, and that doesn't work. Go to God. Get to know him better. Just get to know him better. Bask in his goodness and in his joy and his love, his forgiveness, his deliverance. Get to know him better. Not just facts about him. Get to know him. And begin to float above all the negativity. Just be done with it. All right. Let's move on to chapter 32. Let's turn there. We're going to take some time to read. This is a very, very instructive passage for us. I do hope that after this teaching, you'll go home and this afternoon just really focus in on chapter 32. It says, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had abundant livestock. You can circle that. They had abundant livestock. Very great. They saw the land of Jazer, the land of Gilead, and behold. So you can circle the word saw. They saw. They had a lot of livestock. They saw the land that they were in. And behold, it was a place for livestock. 1 + 1 = 2, doesn't it? The children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and said to Moses, to Eleazar the Cohen, and to the leaders of the assembly, saying, Ataroth and Dibon and Jazer and Nimrah and Heshbon and Eliala and Sabam and Nebo and Beon, the land that Adonai smote before the assembly of Israel, is a land of livestock. God cleared it. He destroyed the enemy here. It's just sitting empty for Pete's sake. And number four, your servants have livestock. Human reasoning at its best. What are they forgetting? They're forgetting that this is not the promised land, though. This is not the land God gives them. This was not the goal. The goal's on the other side of the Jordan. Completely forgot what God's purpose was for their lives. Completely forgot the goal God had for them. We got a lot of livestock. This is great land for livestock. God wiped out the enemy. Here we are. Come on, Moses, let us just camp out here. Let this be our inheritance. And I tell you what, I think it's the most hopping mad I've ever seen Moses. I think he's more angry here than when he broke the tablets coming down with the golden calf. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong. But verse 5 says, if we have found favor in your eyes, let this land be given to your servants as a heritage. Do not bring us across the Jordan. Now, at that verse, it sounds like he plans just to stay put and not cross the Jordan at all. Now, they change their tune a little bit after Moses gives them a royal chewing out. Verse 6, Moses said to the children of Gad and the children of Reuben, shall your brothers go out to battle while you settle here? Why do you discourage or dissuade the heart of the children of Israel from crossing to the land that Adonai has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. They went to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, and they dissuaded the heart of the children of Israel not to come to the land that Adonai has given them. The wrath of Adonai burned on that day, and he swore, saying, if these men who come up from Egypt from the age of 20 years and above will see the ground that I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, for they have not followed me fully, except for Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and the Kenizzite, and Joshua, son of Nun. For they followed me, Adonai, fully. The wrath of Adonai burned against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness for 40 years, until the end of the entire generation that did evil in the eyes of Adonai. Behold, you have risen up in place of your fathers, a society of sinful people, to add more to the burning wrath of Adonai against Israel. For if you will turn away from after him, he will again let it rest in the wilderness, and you will destroy this entire people. Moses is angry. Now he says, you've risen up in place of your fathers. What you're doing is the exact same thing they did 40 years ago. And it is similar, but it's not quite the same. What happened before? They asked, can we send some spies in the land to check it out before we cross? Moses said, okay, So they picked a man from each tribe, 12 men. They go over 40 days. When they come back, Joshua and Caleb says, let's go get them, boys. It's an amazing place. Look at the fruit we brought back. This is going to be awesome. Let's go. But the other 10 said, oh, we can't do that. It's a great land and all, but there are giants over there. The cities are fortified. There's no way we'll win. They'll wipe out our women and children. They're going to kill us all. And they so discouraged the hearts of the Israelites. Now, just the 10 guys had said that, but Israel hadn't lost their faith. God would probably just discipline those 10, and they still would have gone across. But the hearts of the people were so discouraged by the word of these 10 men that the whole generation spent 40 years dying in the wilderness while the young people grew up to take their place. Now, they didn't go in because they were afraid of the land. These men don't want to go in because they love the wilderness. That's the difference. It's possible to spend so much time in the wilderness that you grow to love it, it becomes home. Just like some people want to go back to Egypt, rather than stay in the wilderness, now these want to stay in the wilderness instead of go to the promised land. And in every community and throughout the body of Messiah today, there are people who just want to take their inheritance on the wrong side of the Jordan. Now, they're willing to go and fight. They're willing to go help their brothers and sisters. They encourage them. We'll take our inheritance over here. And we'll write, we'll call, we'll visit, but you all go on in. We'll just stay out here. And there are always people who are happy for others to get discipled, to participate in prayer and in all the things that take place in the body. They're always great about encouraging everyone to keep moving ahead, keep following the Lord, but we're just going to stay back. We're not going to participate. And the danger of that is that it discourages the whole body. It discourages everybody else. When you don't participate and you don't follow God fully with your heart. Here, we're going to do a little exercise. I don't like to make the sheep perform, but this is a little thing I want to ask you to do. I want you sitting right where you're at just to look around. Just go ahead and turn around, do a little rubbernecking, and just look at all the people around you. And as you look around, there are faces there you recognize. There are some good friends, family members, people you know well, and you love them. You love spending time with them. Other people think, well, I know them. I've talked to them a couple of times, casual acquaintance. Other people here I've never talked to, but I wish them all well. And, of course, there might be a few people I just don't like them at all. You can tell these people are because they're sitting on this end and that end, okay? They don't want to get close to each other. I'm teasing. But and it's just the kind of way the things are. And you think, I want everybody to do well. I want everybody to grow. I want everybody to prosper. And it's like, it's all good. Now close your eyes. You've just looked at each other the way Reuben and Gad look at the people and themselves. Now I want you to picture all those faces you saw, the people sitting around you. And if you're visiting, picture your own community, wherever you normally fellowship. But this time I want you to picture the cloud of glory over you, God's presence hovering over the entire community. And then I want you to ask, Father, what do you want of me? How do you want me to speak into the lives of people here, not only that I know, but the people I don't know? Is there someone here you want me to greet? Is there someone here you want me to share my life with? Someone here you want me to pray with? Father, is there something I'm doing or failing to do that discourages the heart of another brother or sister here? Because, Father, it's not about me. It's about we. It's about what you want for all of us. Okay, you can open your eyes. See the different dynamic when you include God in our community? When Reuben and Gad come to Moses, they refer to God one time. He wiped out all the people here. It's just sitting empty. Let us take it. When Moses speaks to them, he uses God's name seven times. seven times, because they were forgetting God in the formula. They were looking only in the level of human logic, looking overly at the practical, looking what was best for their flocks and their possessions. They weren't thinking, what is his will, though? What is his destiny for us? They weren't thinking about the impact they would have on the rest of the community by being absent. You ever been at a gathering and you think, oh, that was such a great time. I wish so-and-so had been with us. Now, why do you say that? Because your joy would have been greater had they been there to enjoy it with you. I know times I've had to travel, and so many times I'll tell the people, I wish Robin was here with me. Because I want her to enjoy it, and watching her enjoy it would make me enjoy it more. And I know she's been places she's had to travel, and she said the same thing. And you know what I'm talking about? Oh, I so wish they could be with us. We're a community, we're a body. And let's communicate and plug into the body. Let's not rob others of the gifts God wants to express through us. You understand? Now, I asked you in the email I sent out this week, I said, what did Reuben and Gad and Manasseh all have in common? Did anybody figure out what it was? What do they all have in common? Something they had no say over. Ah, all right, I will tell you. They were all firstborns. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn through his wife, Leah. Gad was Jacob's firstborn through, I think it was Rachel's handmaid, Bilhah. Manasseh was Joseph's firstborn, who was Jacob's firstborn through Rachel. Now there's a fourth firstborn, that's Dan. That was Jacob's firstborn through the handmaid Zilpah. And Dan shares a similar fate with these three. But see, why I mentioned that is that these four firstborns all had places of preeminence. And so they saw themselves almost in a place of leadership and administration, but not down in the ranks. And so they thought they could get away with some other things. They saw privilege and some authority that the others didn't have. And so they had the chutzpah to come to Moses and say, can we just have our inheritance over here? But Moses listened carefully to their request. And starting in verse 16, this is what they say. They approached him and said, pens for the flock shall we build here. Listen, Moses, don't get this wrong. Pens for the flock shall we build here for our livestock and cities for our small children. We shall arm ourselves swiftly in front of the children of Israel until we will have brought them to their peace, their place, and their small children will dwell in the fortified cities. We shall not return to our homes until the children of Israel will have inherited every man his inheritance. For we shall not inherit with them across the Jordan and beyond. For our inheritance has come to us on the east bank of the Jordan. And then Moses corrects them. There are actually four things they say wrong. Well, we're going to focus on the three main ones. They said, then they came near to him and said, we will build here sheepfolds for our livestock. All right? And cities for our little ones. What do they mention first? Where are their priorities? But when Moses answers them back in verse 24, he says, okay, build yourself cities for your little ones and sheepfolds for your sheep. He reasserts the priorities because their priorities were wrong. And then in verse 17, they said, but we ourselves will be armed, ready to go right in front of the sons of Israel. Moses caught it immediately. He knew that what they said was wrong. He corrects it in verse 21. And all of you armed men cross over the Jordan before Adonai. You're going to fight Adonai's battle. It's not just about the sons of Israel. God's name is at stake here. This is about him. And then the third thing they get wrong. We will not return to our home until every one of the sons of Israel has possessed his inheritance. You see what's wrong? Moses corrects it. at the end of verse 21 and 22. He says, you'll return to your, won't return home until Adonai, until he has driven his enemies out from before him, and the land is subdued before Adonai. See, in other words, it's not until the sons of Israel come to their possession, but until Adonai has accomplished the battle. Reuben and Gad could only see things through a limited human perspective of their physical need, and they left God out of the formula. If we are going to be a spiritual people, if we're going to be followers of Messiah, we never leave God out of the formula. Everything we do is about him. In him, we live, we move, we have our being. All of our service to one another is for him. The only way we can serve him is by serving one another. And to connect with one another is to connect with him in a more deep way. Don't ever get in your mind, I'm going to connect with God instead of people. It doesn't work that way. To the degree you connect with one another, to that degree you can connect with him. It's a package deal. There aren't two great commandments, there's one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. It goes like that. It's together. You do them both, you do neither. Because there's not one single thing God needs from you. But there are a lot of things we need from you. And the way you serve God is by serving his people. That's all it's done. Let's not be like Reuben and Gad. And then what happens when they get their way? Then we find half the tribe of Manasseh decides to go along with them. One tribe now is split. There's a fracture in the community. So, in closing, let's look at the end of the story. Let's fast forward a couple centuries, 1 Chronicles 5:26. So the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, even the spirit of Tilgath-Pilneser, king of Assyria. Oh, I love those names. And they carried them away into exile. Who did he carry away? The Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Took them into captivity. They were the first ones to be taken captive by the king of Babylon. They didn't come into their inheritance. And you know, I have to wonder, if they had said, you know, Moses, forgive us. We lost the sight of God's vision for us. We lost sight of the inheritance and his plan for us. We're going in, we're going to take our inheritance in the land of Canaan. I wonder if the people would have fallen into idolatry later as they did. Because they would have the entire 12 tribes together. And maybe Assyria never would have come in and conquered them and taken them captive at all. But because of their short-sightedness, they broke the body and later it crumbled. Each of us have such an important part in our community and the body of Messiah. Don't ever underestimate who you have to contribute. And don't ever underestimate how much you mean to everyone else. Don't rob us of your presence. Don't rob us of your gifts. Speak into the lives of one another. Tell one another that you appreciate them, you love them. Find out the needs of the people sitting around you. Pray for them. Pray with them. They're just right there. It's the easiest thing in the world to do. Just do it. Don't build walls around yourself. Walls of protection become a prison, you know. We build walls, think we're protecting ourselves, we find out we're in solitary confinement. And it's our fault. Open up your lives. Lay your life down for one another. To that degree, your life will have meaning and purpose. And with that, we'll close in prayer. Unless you have some comments. Any comments or questions? I see one over here, Ben. Let's get a microphone to Ben and then Brandon. And I left my thing of water somewhere. I sat it down somewhere when I was talking to somebody. But okay, Ben. Yes, sir.
I just have a question.
You have to bang that microphone against something. There we go.
There we go. Maybe?
Yeah, now we can.
The picture, after, when you put it up there, I could only see the positive.
Okay.
But after you pointed out the negative, it was hard to look at it anymore and not focus on the negative.
Yeah.
And I thought, why is that?
Yeah. Well, that's I'm glad you asked that. What Ben said, if you couldn't quite hear him, he says, when I put the picture up, all he could see was the positive. That's a beautiful girl. But once I pointed out the ugly old woman, the name of this picture, by the way, is The Young Wife and the Mother-in-Law. Just to let you know. But after I pointed out the ugly old woman, that's all he could see. That is the power of negativity. How many times have you thoroughly enjoyed something, been blessed by something, and it was just wonderful, and somebody came along and says, yeah, but let me tell you about that guy you just saw performing up there. Or let me tell you about this. Let me fill you in on the other info. And they speak something negative into it, and you think, ugh. And all your joy goes. You can't see the positive anymore. That's the power of negativity. It lets all the air out of your tires. Thank you for bringing that up. It's a great example. Brandon, your hand was up.
These things ever work?
Half the time. Only when no one's talking.
Okay. So you were talking about Midian and how they,
yes,
they conquered the land, or I mean, the Israelites took vengeance on them.
Yeah.
And how, you know, it kind of seems a little intense and not, you know, all loving and everything of God. And I really saw where you were coming from and everything, but at the same time, when I saw that, you know, they had kept the women alive, that mm-hmm. the very ones that they fell into idolatry with, that mm-hmm. made sense, kill them.
Yeah.
But one thing I was kind of weirded out by, and even that it was first, was kill the little boys too.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of like a 2-year-old boy that they just kill. I mean, mm-hmm. So could you maybe elaborate on that?
Yeah, rather not right now. yeah, why'd they kill the little boys? Basically because little boys grow up to be men. And the women, you can assume, were very much abused by the Midianite men. And a woman's more adaptive than men are. And so when they took the women, the virgin women, in, and they just kind of folded them into the people of Israel, they became Israelites. But you can't do that with the little boys so well. And but looking at it in a spiritual sense, the boys carry the seed. So the seed of Midian, the seed of strife, contention, negativity is carried there. And God says you have to wipe out every bit of that seed. And by the way, speaking again of Midian and negativity, remember how Midian wanted to destroy the Jews? I don't think I mentioned this during the teaching, but in the Torah service I did. They hired Balaam to come in and to use negative words to curse the people. Speak negativity over the people, Balaam, because who you curse, God curses. Of course, every time he opened his mouth, blessing came out. That kind of made Balak mad. But they lived up to their name of strife, contention, judgmentalism. Speak negativity, Balaam. You see what I'm saying? So everything about Midian is just negativity and strife and contention, and God says, I don't want any of it, none of it. The girls represent vessels. The feminine always represents a vessel. And he says, but these vessels that are untainted, they can carry a different seed, and they can birth something else. But the boys have that Midianite nature, and they'll grow up to be men like their fathers. They can't have them. They can't be part of Israel. So killing them is more merciful than just saying, just leave them in the wilderness, let them starve, let the animals eat them. Okay, so the killing them was an act of mercy rather than just abandoning them in the wilderness. Okay, so I guess I did comment on that some, didn't I? Okay, one more comment and then we're going to have to close. So Angela will give you the last word. Right down here in the very front. Yeah. Just throw it. She'll catch it. What's the worst that can happen, huh? It'll work then. It'll get banged against something.
What you just talked about the how God said when you are to destroy everyone, you really do have to do what he says. It reminds me of the story, as you were talking about the little boys, of Amalek. Am I picturing the right person?
Exactly, you are.
That
yes.
He was not killed, and the night before mm-hmm. he was to be killed, someone came to serve him, a woman,
yeah.
And he planted his seed.
Yes.
And that seed then proceeded to our lifetime, my lifetime, mm-hmm. in the events of World War II yeah. and the Nuremberg trials.
Yeah. Well, and Haman. Haman exactly. came out of that union. If Saul had followed through and killed that king, king of Amalek, Haman had never been born, who tried to wipe out all the Jewish people there in the book of Esther. Yeah. So
and
that
then that
seed
goes on to World War II,
yeah.
where, and I don't remember the details.
Yeah, that's
of it
the spirit of Amalek.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was
yes,
thinking.
Yes, very much. Yeah, thank you. Good insight. And with that, we will close now. So, our Father, our King, we thank you for the wisdom, the beauty, the light that it just shines forth from your Torah. And Lord, I pray you'd help us to be people who have a positivity bias. We'll always look for the best in others. We know, Father, that you've promised that a bruised reed you will not break and a smoking flax you will not quench. If there's the slightest bit of strength and a fire in a person, you want to protect that and cause it to grow and to flourish. Father, help us to be the same way. Instead of saying, oh, that reed's bruised. Oh, that flax is only smoking. Lord, I pray you'd help us to encourage it, to rise above and become what all it can be. Make us people like Messiah. Lord, you tell us in your word, God is love. We are to imitate you. May we be walking, talking examples of love in the world around us. Help us still be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. But help us be very, very measured whenever we speak anything that could possibly be damaging to another person's life. And this we will do with your help. And we ask it in Yeshua's name. Amen.